Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Kaplan Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can reach us through restaurantguysradio.com.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm very well. Very well.
I'm glad to hear it.
I love this time of year.
I particularly love this time of year.
What's not to love?
Well, you know, one of the things that you hear us all the time talking about how, you know, what fruit is coming in. In the summertime, it's so rapid to live here locally. It's different eating locally in the winter than it is in the summer. And, you know, when the first asparagus comes in, Mark and I sit down and have a plate of asparagus and a bottle of Muscat from the Alsace. Mm-hmm. That's our little tradition. I know we're corny, right? But
you know, a lot of people, you know, mark the passing of time with the seasons, and Francis and I kind of do it a little differently. We anticipate the next season
of food.
The next piece of produce or type of food that comes into season, whether it's spring lamb or cherries or whatever it might be. Francis and I are anticipating the next season by which foods they are, and I guess we're a little wacky that way.
Well, but also I think that a great restaurant has to plan for that. You know, you have mm-hmm. to be ready. It's not like you can have the cherries come in when it's, okay, what am I going to do with these now? You know, you have to sort of have mm-hmm. an idea. But one of the things that is new to us, and I'm surprised more restaurants aren't doing it, and I think you'll see it. And I want you to all remember that it started with us more than 2 years ago.
3 years.
Is one of the things we're doing now as fresh strawberries came in and as blueberries are coming in and, you know, nectarines will come in later in the season. We're putting up these fruits, and as tomatoes, of course, come in through August and September, we're putting up these local fruits for use in the fall, like we did last year. We'll put up almost 10,000 pounds of locally grown San Marzano tomatoes for the spaghetti sauce or the mm-hmm. the gravy.
For all the all the tomato based things that we might use
in Kaplan Lombardi, but we'll also put up fruits, various fruits in liquor, and we have a whole root cellar now in Stage Left and Kaplan Lombardi. It's one root cellar for both restaurants, mm-hmm. so that we can continue to eat locally all year round, and it's really enhanced our marking of these seasons as they come by. We put up strawberries. Now, the strawberries and blueberries, they don't really hold their shape very well, mm-hmm. and they express a lot of water, so you need to cook them down a little bit. And we don't quite make a conserve or a preserve or a jam.
Well, we're doing lots of different things. Actually, we did make a preserve with strawberries.
But the strawberries themselves don't mm-hmm. hold up as individual strawberries. I mean, they sort of hold up, but they don't hold their shape as well as, say, a nectarine or a sugar plum, which looks exactly like a nectarine or a sugar plum by the time you get it, or certainly apples or quince. But what's interesting now is when something comes in, we use it and we have a priority to get it out into the restaurants and on the menus and into the tables and into our homes. And we also have a priority like, okay, this is the time to put up sugar plums.
Or it's too late.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that's become interesting too is now there's becoming a little depth in the root cellar too. So there are some 2 year old pears down in the cellar, and they're a little bit different and they're a little bit different than the 1 year old pears which are in the wine cellar. First, because of what we did differently from year to year, which, you know, every year we're trying some new and interesting things. But also they're different because the fruit was a little different 1 year from the next, or came from a different farm 1 year from the next. And those nuances, those subtleties, they're great. And I encourage everybody to be able to bask in those.
Well, and it makes it great for this season when we're putting stuff up. It's very exciting for us to put up, you know, to put up a whole shelf of nectarines or something mm-hmm. of the sort. And it's also exciting in January when we bust those suckers out.
It's more exciting in January. Yeah. Honestly, it's even more exciting when you kind of pop open those first couple of jars and say, how did we do? Did this come out the way we hoped it would come out? And you know, at home, this is something that you can do. There are, basically, you just need go buy some mason jars at you know, your local whatever store, hardware store. Buy some mason jars and some lids and go online, get some directions, and do this. There's a lot of opportunity to do these kinds of things at home. You know, I have some friends who can their own tomatoes as well, and their family's been doing it for 60, 70, 80, 100 years of canning, and they spend one Sunday a year, and the whole family gets together, and they canned tomatoes. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's one of those great traditions, and it's a lot of work. Okay, don't kid yourself. It's a lot of work to do all that work. But they basically set up an assembly line of 15 or 20 people in the family, and the the family spends the day together like you would have 40 or 50 years ago. And there's bonding that happens in those times. I mean, my father bought a farm when I was young, and you guys have heard me talk about this a lot. But my father and I did a lot of work on that farm together. My brother, my father, and I, my grandmother, my great uncle. We spent a lot of time working, and we, again, it was an acre that we planted, and we went up there on weekends, and my grandmother and my great uncle tended to it
during the week.
And we did, you know, we did the heavy lifting, as it were, on the weekends. But it was great. It was a great way to come together. And then at the end of the day, we always sat down and had dinner together, or something that we had tilled, farmed, pulled up, taken out of the root cellar, whichever. And that was a great bonding experience. And there's not enough of that today.
Well, and I want to talk about our relationship with food, if you can do this. But this is something you can do even if you don't have a farm or access to a farm. You're not a farmer yourself, but you can go to the green market and buy some local produce. When you participate in the food that you share with whomever you share it, and you have food that looks to the past, and you're looking to the present to what's seasonal, it really is a fuller way to live life. Mm-hmm. I know I'm getting a little philosophical here, but let me give you an example. We teach wine classes all the time. German Rieslings, even with the dollar to the euro the way it is right now, represent a very good value, and they're often, even inexpensive German Rieslings, good inexpensive German Rieslings, are quite age-worthy and really do change and improve with age. I always suggest if people are going to buy 12 bottles of wine, buy a case of one wine, even a German Riesling, simple German Riesling, put it down in your cellar. Because you taste it now, and then maybe 6 months from now, a year from now, a year and a half from now, 2.5 years from now, that's your case of wine that you go back to. If you bring it over to someone's house, or if you invite someone over your house, you go down to the cellar to get that case of wine that you've been aging. You're participating in your own history, and there's a continuity there. And the same thing works with putting up fruit. Even if you just make some, you know, preserves, some strawberry preserves, or you can put up some nectarines, or you can put up some tomatoes this summer that you can pull out for a special dinner, even if it's 5 jars.
I mean, I've heard of people bringing up stuff out of their cellar 10 years after their grandmother passed away, and celebrating their grandmother's life, and with a jar of some preserved fruit that their grandmother put up years and years ago, even though she's gone. I mean, that's what's better than that?
And even on a smaller scale, for you to look to the future, when you do then break that open in January, maybe, you open on a gloomy day, you open those summer tomatoes that you put up, and you remember the day you put them up.
Mm-hmm.
Or you share with someone that you've invited over to your house, so, you know, we put these up in August. It's a very special thing.
And maybe spend 8 hours with your family, with no telephone, with no text messaging, with no computers, and just focused on each other and the tasks at hand.
It's sort of like dying Easter eggs in a much greater scale. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. And our guest today is Sergio Esposito. He's the owner of the Italian Wine Merchant in New York City. He speaks at and hosts wine dinners throughout the country. He's got a great website and a popular email newsletter, and he's just written a wonderful book. It's a wine memoir, really, called Passion on the Vine.
Sergio, welcome to the show.
Thank you, guys. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, the wine memoir is becoming a new sort of a genre of book. Yours is particularly interesting. Wine is at the center of it, but it's not just about wine, is it?
No, it's not. And actually, you know what, you bring up a very good point, because I didn't write this book to be a wine book. I wrote it to be an Italian lifestyle book. And when you talk about Italian lifestyle, you're really talking about all things that encompass that lifestyle, which are wine, family, food, and then the beauty of the country. And so that's really what the book is about.
I've said this before on the show, Sergio. They do it better than we do.
Yeah.
Okay. It's just they do it better than we do. The Italians have locked in this lovely little niche of life that we've skipped over so many of the best parts of.
You know, I'll tell you, I think the United States is the greatest country in the world, and it's the greatest country for business, it's the greatest country for commerce, for freedom, for so many other things, opportunity. There's no other country that provides those things the way the United States does. But Italy, in terms of lifestyle, they really figured something else over there, and I think we could learn just a little bit from them. And the book is really explaining what that lifestyle is, and you know, it took me a long time to write it, but I think I try to nail it as best as possible.
Well, you know, Sergio, I think one of the things that's very interesting is Mark is an Italian American fellow. He's got a little French in him, but he's mostly Italian American. I'm Irish American, and I go back to Ireland to visit my family, and Mark's been back to France to visit his family, and Italy as well. And it's interesting, being generations down the line. You actually immigrated as a boy to the United States, right?
I did. We came when I was about 6.5 years old in 1974.
And I think that one of the wonderful things about your book is you really put into sharp relief leaving Italy with your impressions of Italy as a boy having lived there, you know, cognizant and conscious of food and life there to a certain extent, and then coming to Ithaca, New York, as an Italian immigrant.
Right, actually Albany, New York.
I'm sorry,
and,
Albany, okay.
And there are two chapters, one that talks about my life before 1974 and one right after when I came to the United States. And it's really to explain a little bit of the culture clash. And in Italy, of course, my perspective was from a six-year-old boy and what I saw around me, because I lived in Naples from 1968 when I was born in 74. And, of course, there were a tremendous amount of things that were wrong in a sense. There was the Red Brigade. There was cholera epidemic. It was a tremendous amount of unemployment, but I didn't see any of that because I had this tremendous and loving family who supported each other and spent as much time as they could together around food and wine, and that was really the wealth of what I saw. And so for me, that time period of my life is just full of with extreme richness, and I brought that out. And then when we moved to the United States, obviously there was a culture clash because Albany, New York is a place where we couldn't find a lot of our ingredients, a lot of the same type of people that we were accustomed to. We didn't have a strong family network like we had in Italy. And so slowly we started to lose the sense of who we were. But then thankfully my mother figured out that it was very important for us to remember that. And so every day at every meal she tried to reproduce our lifestyle in Italy.
You should have moved to Nutley, New Jersey. You would have found it much more accommodating.
No,
I don't doubt that for a second.
No, but I think it's interesting that you move, and you did move to like, you know, a place in New York where there wasn't a large Italian American or Italian immigrant community. And you know, we're going to get to wine, folks, in a few minutes. But the book, like you said, is about more than wine. I thought it was interesting how you talked about, or you sort of made an offhand reference to, as you were in Albany longer, you came to appreciate the theretofore unimaginable appeal of peanut butter. You know,
right.
And like American foods. But was wine one of the things that always was distinctly reminded you of Italy, and was it Italian?
Yes, because it again, when you talk about the Italian table and Italian lifestyle, wine is no more and no less important on the table than salt or than bread. But then, of course, those are the most important things on the table. So it wasn't something that we ever fussed about. There wasn't something that, you know, my dad never sat around really throwing out wine terms and chasing the next bottle. It was just something that always needed to be there, just like a loved one at the table. And so for me, it was one of those things that it was about the warmth. It was about the comfort of wine and always having it around. It didn't matter if it was bad. It didn't matter if it, you know, it didn't taste like a great vintage bottle. All that mattered is that it was represented every day.
A lot of gallon jugs in my family.
There's nothing wrong with that. Listen, I mean, the important part is that you're sharing it with people that you love and that, you know, it's something that you can share together.
There's a moment in your book, and I forget, forgive me if I get this wrong, but was it your father who, when you ran out of wine, said there was no wine for dinner?
We might as well have soup. Yeah, yeah, I mean, you know, on Sundays in the United States, we have those laws, those blue laws, I think they're called. And so if we ran out of wine on a Sunday and then the Sunday meal was coming, my dad would just be depressed for the rest of the day. No more than he would have been depressed if his wife wasn't there or if, you know, his children weren't there. But he was depressed nonetheless. You might as well have canceled dinner and, you know, let's just have a soup and go to bed.
Yeah, like I would have been depressed if Grandma didn't make the meatballs.
That's
same way.
You expect it.
When we come back in a moment, we're going to talk more with Sergio Esposito about his wonderful new book, Passion of the Vine. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:25. The Feluga family at the Livio Feluga Winery are masters of modern winemaking, rooted deeply in Italian tradition. Founder and patriarch Livio Feluga has been counted among the seven most influential Italian winemakers in the last 100 years. Signore Feluga pioneered the Friuli method. It's a style of winemaking that focuses on the purity of the fruit and the expression of the soil. It's made Livio Feluga Pinot Grigio the standard bearer for high-quality artisanal Pinot Grigio. It's serious, interesting, deeply rooted wine that speaks of the very essence of Friuli, from whence it comes. But with Livio Feluga, it's not only Pinot Grigio. Feluga wines offer a world of adventurous choices. Have you ever had a wonderful Ribolla Gialla or a Picolite? Well, if you haven't, then you're missing some very special Italian wine indeed. Feluga makes red wines like Verdigo, which is Cabernet and Merlot, or Sasso, which is made with the Italian grapes Refosco and Pignolo. Start with Pinot Grigio, the way it's supposed to be, and then, through the efforts of Livio Feluga, take a tour of Friuli, glass by glass, sip by sip. Ask for Livio Feluga wines at your local wine shop, or look for them online. Tell them you heard about it on The Restaurant Guys. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Cafe Lombardi Restaurants. We're talking with Sergio Esposito. He's the owner of the Italian Wine Merchants in New York City. His book is Passion on the Vine, a memoir of food, wine, and the family in the heart of Italy. So you come to the United States as an immigrant at 12 years old, and you...
At 6 years old.
Well, how old were you when you came here?
Six and a half.
By the time you graduate high school, you've assimilated somewhat into American society, or no?
Of course. I mean, you know, my parents were very influential in that because they've never really learned the English language, but they made sure that we spoke it as well as we could have. But they also made sure that we remembered our Italian and our Neapolitan, our dialect. So yeah.
So you realized that Albany wasn't for you.
Yeah, I think by the time I was 12, I figured out that all.
Actually, can I bring it out in full, flesh it out fully? You liken it to an insane asylum.
No, I didn't liken it to an insane asylum.
All right, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but it's fun.
You know, there was a famous movie in the 50s about a man in a gray suit, I think was the name of it. And it was about people on the block just basically all looking the same and doing the same thing and not wanting change in a sense. And when you take an immigrant out of a place like Naples and you bring him and drop him in the middle of New York State in a town like Albany, one of the things that immigrant will do is he'll start to mythologize Italy, and that's what I did. I started to mythologize all those ideas that I had and all those memories that I had of what Italy is, and of course only the good parts is what you look at. And so I would spend a lot of time dreaming of, you know, going back to Italy and visiting Italy and reconnecting with Italy in a sense.
I wasn't born there, and I still do that, Sergio.
Yeah, well, you know, for me it was even worse. But looking around in Albany, looking at my neighbors in my particular block in Albany, in a particular area, because I will say there are some areas that are different, but it just wasn't my experience, I noticed that everyone in Albany was pretty content of just doing the same things every day and not wanting change and not wanting to move. And so for me at the time, I thought, you know, these people, they're either had a lobotomy or something's going on because, you know, I know things can be different, they can be better, they can be more beautiful, and why wouldn't you be?
After the news, we're going to come back and talk more with Sergio about his journey from being an immigrant child growing up in Albany, New York, to becoming perhaps the leading Italian wine merchant in the United States. So come back after the news. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:30.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Cafe Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Our guest today is Sergio Esposito. He is the owner of the Italian Wine Merchants in New York City. He's a noted speaker on Italian wine, an authority on Italian wine, and his wonderful memoir is Passion on the Vine, a memoir of food, wine, and family in the heart of Italy. You can find out more about it or even order it, if you like, on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Sergio, we've been talking about sort of the immigrant experience and you coming to America as a young boy and then growing up and being assimilated into the American culture while retaining, you know, your memories of Italy and maybe the fantasies you have of Italy. When you first went back, did you see the negatives in Italy, or were you just thrilled to be back in Italy?
You know, I think that that's one of the advantages that I have in doing what I do, because when I go to Italy, I have a connection with the people right away, but I have a connection because I don't go there as a tourist. And there's an Italian saying, which is, an Englishman goes to Italy, and you show him the Colosseum, and he goes, wow, this is beautiful, it's beautiful, and then you show him St. Peter's, and he goes, wow, it's beautiful, and beautiful. And then you show him a dump site, and he goes, wow, this is beautiful, it's beautiful. And for Italians, we think, you know, well, they think everything here is beautiful, but the reality is that there's a lot of hardship in Italy, and there's a lot of bureaucracy that you have to get through, and so on and so forth. And so I realize those things, and those things intrigue me just as much as the beauty of Italy. And so I think I have an ability to really connect with the mindset of the people, the struggle of the people, and what they have to go through. And so even in searching wines or looking for food, one of the advantages I think that I have is that I can cut through all of the marketing crap that they will give people over and over again mm-hmm. when they visit there and go right to the heart of the person and figure out what his real motivation is and what his, in a sense, what his obstacles are.
Do you find that that the motivations are truer in Italy when you're dealing with a farmer or a winemaker than the experiences you have here in the United States?
I wouldn't say truer in a sense. I would say that a lot of times the American perception is that the old world winemakers in France and Germany and Italy are these, you know, this couple with a pitchfork standing in front of their farm, like the Rockwell painting. And in a true sense, it's not often like that. For instance, in the South, the number one driving force for people setting up their own wineries in their own states is because they want to create a job for their children.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you think of that, you think about their motivation behind that, there's a lot of love, because whatever they're putting into their wine, they're putting in because they're putting in that love for creating a safety net for their child. And so to understand that is something that sometimes doesn't make sense to an American when you ask an Italian, you know, beyond all of the other stuff, why are you truly setting up your estate? And he says, well, because my child is 2 years old and I want to make sure they have an income when they're 30.
And some of that comes just from, you know, this is the vineyard that's been in the family for 300 years, so it needs to continue to stay in the family. That's just just part of the culture, as opposed to, you know, we made a lot of money and we bought an expensive piece of property in California and we're out here kind of.
And I want 99 points from Robert Parker, and I'll keep firing winemakers until I get it.
Yeah, no, there it's a little bit different.
Well,
and unfortunately, some of them chase the Robert Parker thing too. But that's a whole other story, I guess.
Well, you know, one of the things I think that's interesting about your book, a favorite book of Mark and mine, and we've been teaching wine classes for, oh, God, is it 20 years?
Almost, it's a long time.
About 20 years out here in Jersey, in the
you
provinces.
You're aging yourself.
Okay? I know,
exactly.
My heavens. We were born 3 years before you. I know. Yours is in a book. Nobody has to look me up. So we were born in 65, and we've been teaching. We taught our first wine class in Jersey in 89 or 90, mm-hmm. One of those two. And, you know, we operate a couple of restaurants, and we do some consulting advice for other restaurants. We had a wine shop for a while, which we turned into a restaurant. And
Mark.
One of the things...
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. That's what we said. What are we doing this for? Yeah, make food? Sit down.
Go to Italian wine merchants. Buy your wine there.
Exactly. Yeah. Buy from Sergio. But one of the things that we've found over the years is we've gone to Italy with some of our importers. So we've mm-hmm. gone to Italy and France and Spain and Portugal with some of our importers, and we've traveled the world.
Austria.
Austria, right? We've traveled the world quite a bit, either to buy wine for ourselves or to visit producers that we buy on a regular basis or to find new things to import ourselves. And it is completely a different experience to go there being in the business, and of course the best business to go there being in is the food or the wine business, because the hospitality and the access you receive is remarkable. And the first book that I read that captured that sort of set me on the path of I need to do this, was Kermit Lynch's book, On the Wine Route, which is, God, that was published in like 1990?
I think even before that.
Yeah,
was it
I think it was 80.
I think 80.
80? Was it
was
80?
That long ago? Wow.
Wow, heavens
yeah.
to Betsy.
We're old.
But this book is very much in that genre. It's not exactly following a wine merchant around in the same exact way, but there are elements to that in this book as well.
Well, you know, in this book, again, the wine part, I think, the wine component, I wanted to write it in a sense so that it would be digestible for anyone to read. So if you're not a wine drinker and if you're not really interested in the whole wine story in a sense, you still could get through the chapters where it's more wine heavy in a sense and enjoy them. And that was the real trick of this book, and how was I going to present a book that, you know, someone, the reader that I was thinking about is someone that lives in middle America somewhere who's probably never been to Italy but would love to go and likes to travel from their armchair and or has been to Italy and loves it but isn't necessarily a person that has, you know, a 3,000-bottle cellar and goes to tastings every weekend. And so presenting it to that person was really important for me because a lot of times in our industry, in the wine industry, we want to create a private club that is exclusive to, you know, members that we allow in, and that's it. And we want to keep information for ourselves and pretend to be snobs and whatever it is. And that's not what wine is about, at least not for me, and not the way that I was brought up and not the way that it was taught to me. The way that it was taught to me is if you love something, you share it. You share it with the world, and that's what I wanted to do in this book.
That's great, and I think you accomplished that. Although I do have to call you out on one thing, Sergio.
Nice.
You kind of lament the 22-hour day of tasting, you know, going from vineyard to vineyard, tasting, and going from restaurant to restaurant and tasting this food and that food.
You don't
and
believe a word of that.
Well, I'm going to be honest with you. I've done it, and it's the best part of my life. Okay?
I'll tell you about it. Usually on those trips, I'm the most miserable person you've ever met in your life for 21 hours of those days. But then there's always that 1 hour. It's like playing golf for me. It's the worst experience of my life. But then I hit that one sweet shot, and I go, yes, I'm doing this again.
You know,
the same thing in those
trips. You're right. It is a lot like that. You meet that one winemaker.
Yeah.
You find that one wine. I remember... Oh, back in the mid-90s, Francis and I went to VinItaly, which is a big conference in Verona. And I remember meeting Thomas Busola.
Right.
And I remember trying his wines, and just, it was one of those
those
moments, you know, that you have in your life.
You're chasing that one experience. But for most of the day, you're miserable. You're in a car. The guy next to you is smoking cigarettes and won't stop smoking. you just want to shoot yourself.
And there's a lot of bad wine out there. That's the part that I think some people don't realize. There's a lot of plunk.
Well, you know, work is work.
That's
true. You know what's funny is, and we're going to take a quick break and come right back. But when I do teach wine classes, people, you know, I always give out a bibliography of suggested readings. And I give a lot of books about titles about how to go and find out about specific things, or how to order specific things. But there's only been one book that I've, and Kevin Cirelli's Windows in the World Wine Course book is the greatest primer for, you know, how to understand the how-tos of basic wines. But I've always had that one book was Adventures on the Wine Route, was not about how-to. And I think that your book is not about how to. It's not like a wine textbook or a reference work in any way. But it's about why bother? Why is all this stuff important? And to me, that's what I see your book as being about. Is that a fair characterization?
You know what? I would say thank you to that because my goal in the book was really to explain that in the Italian way, the goal is always important. And the goal is pleasure. It's not, you know, the goal is not getting a high score. The goal is not being patted on the back because you guessed something right, because you said raspberry and everybody agrees that it's raspberry. Who writes raspberry?
It's a great wine contest.
Yeah, and I think what we've done here in the United States, in a sense, is kind of create a competition, and wine is about competition. It's about, you know, do you know what's in the glass? Do you know what you're smelling? Do you know this? Do you know that? And in Italy, it's about the payoff, and the payoff has to be pleasure if you're doing this. If you're going to sit down to a meal, if you're going to sit down and open a good bottle of wine, if you're going to cook a meal for yourself or have someone else do a proper job, you have to enjoy it at the end of the day. And not everyone is going to be capable in their life of tasting blind of 45, you know, Lafite and figuring out what it is. But everyone can sit down and enjoy something, and that's really what the book is about.
And the wine is contextualized inside life,
and
inside that, inside a meal with the other people who you're with, and celebrating whatever you're celebrating.
Right. And the book, for me, I try to put as much insight into from the Italian perspective as I could, so that my goal was that if you were a wine collector, in a sense, or a sommelier or a professional, that you would read the book and you would still find a tremendous amount of insight into what the winemakers and the whole wine scene is in Italy. And that would appease you. And I've been getting a lot of emails from sommeliers and other people that say, man, I never realized Italy was all about this. But yet again, if you were not a wine sommelier, you could still read it, and all of that stuff is very digestible because it's not about, you know, the pH level or what brick you're picking grapes at and all that other stuff. It's really about what's in the mind of the person who's doing it.
Sergio Esposito's wine memoir is called Passion on the Vine, and we'll be back in just a moment to talk more with him about it. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:46.
Hey, Francis, what's your first choice of hotel in New Jersey?
Easy question, Mark. It's the Heldrich Hotel and Conference Center.
You stay there because it's so convenient, right across the street from the restaurants, right?
I stay there because it's awesome. The rooms are elegant and stylish and comfortable. The service is slick and professional and kind. Did you know they have a swimming pool and a full-service spa?
You know you're a decadent guy, right?
I do, and that's why I stay at the Heldrich.
Well, I stay there for more practical reasons. It's right in the heart of New Brunswick, so you can walk to all the great restaurants and brew pubs and cafes and three world-class theaters. You can even catch the train to Manhattan and be there in less than an hour. And if you want to dine or have a drink in the hotel, Christopher's Restaurant and Bar is right there.
The Heldrich is also great for business. In our dining rooms, we meet a ton of people who book corporate events, meetings, and conferences there, and they're all happy. With 248 rooms, 14 suites, and over 25,000 square feet of state-of-the-art meeting and conference space, the Heldrich can do up to 450 for meetings, social events, and even great weddings.
It's only 25 minutes from Newark Airport. There's a direct train from New Brunswick and frequent shuttles. How easy is that?
To plan a meeting or book a leisurely getaway, call the Heldrich at 866-609-4700. Visit theheldrich.com or click through the link on our website. Ask for the Restaurant Guys promo or online enter promo code Catherine to get a special rate just for our listeners. That's 866-609-4700, theheldrich.com, or click the link on Restaurant Guys Radio. The promo code is Catherine. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi. We're talking with Sergio Esposito about his book, Passion on the Vine. It's a wine memoir of Italy. You talk about not only wine, but you talk about food a lot in the book, and sort of there's a battle for the soul of the wine world for regional authenticity and food and wine going on, and I think the Italy's a real forefront of that kind of place. You talk about your experience at a Michelin-rated restaurant. You want to share with us a little bit of that story?
Well, I think that story kind of sets the pace for the book. First and foremost, you cannot be an Italian wine expert, if you want to call a person such a thing, but you just can't do Italian wines unless you understand the food, because it's something that absolutely goes together. I truly believe you can be a California wine expert, or you can be, you know, a South American wine expert, and not know the food, but you just can't do Italy, because they have to go hand in hand. So in the book, every time that I present wine, I present them around food, and I present them around that context of how they should be shared together. So that was really important in order to do. But the first chapter really sets the pace, because it sets it, instead of setting the idea of what's going on in Italy now, with there's almost a battle between the modernist and the traditionalist, and the country in its sense is really the audience that's paying attention, and they're the deciding vote. And I think what happens in Italy will eventually trickle to the rest of the world. And what's happened in Italy is that, unfortunately, just like the wines, to have 3 stars in a Michelin restaurant, you need to do the same food that they're doing in Paris, or you need to do the same food that they're doing in New York or in Hong Kong, where the Michelin reviewers are just not going to give you those 3 stars.
So the Michelin reviewers are looking for foams and infusions in the modern style, and so
they're looking for advanced techniques in food, right? They're looking for dishes that chefs that put a tremendous amount of their work into the food. And that's not what Italian food is about. Italian food has always been about simplicity. Italian food is about taking a fish straight from the Mediterranean, cooking it in an oven with a little bit of olive oil, a little bit of parsley, a little bit of lemon, and you're done.
And regionalization. If you talk about Italian food, you have to talk about regionalization, about each space, each area of Italy being specific, having specific foods, and doing specifically things their way.
And that's the wonderful part. Now, I've done a lot of interviews in the last few years where the interviewer said, isn't it, you know, difficult in Italy, and don't you think it's bad that they don't have one standard wine or one standard style like Spain has, for instance? And I say, absolutely not. That's the greatest wealth that Italy has, which is diversity. That's what you go to Italy for. You don't go because you can drive from town to town and see the same thing, or eat the same thing or drink the same thing.
Well, and you talk about it. And you talk about in the book when you find the traditional restaurant that you were initially looking for, a restaurant called Baby, is it?
Well, that's a restaurant that, in a sense, is not truly traditional. You know, it's in a beautiful hotel in the middle of Rome. But the owners took their traditional menu that they had in this place called Don Alfonso in the south, and they brought it up to Rome and started doing the food there. But the idea is that it's the simplicity of food.
Well, and the food there is simple and informed by those traditions, but you know, just because a food's traditional doesn't mean it's a rote recipe, right?
No, you know, in Italy, that's the thing. You'll never have two Italians agree on the same dish, because even the way that we've never standardized food. The French will, you know, they'll do a mirepoix, and a mirepoix has to be vegetables that are cut in a certain diameter, or they'll dice, or they'll chop, you know, and everything has to be symmetrical. The Italians don't do that. Italian mothers and grandmothers or husbands or whatever, they cook with a knife standing over the pot and just cutting it, you know, vegetable in a different way. And you'll always get two sisters that will disagree the way the grandmother used to make a dish. One will say it has parsley, one will say it doesn't have parsley. And so every household in Italy really changes the dish just a tiny bit. And you know, the hand of the chef is what makes all the difference.
And the reality is they were probably both right, and it depended on what day grandma was cooking.
Exactly. The important part is that you're not throwing an item in there like gingered at that moment. that you might find in a Michelin-starred restaurant.
I have to say, we've been talking about this wonderful book, which you can find out through our websites. But if you're in Manhattan and or you want to check out some great Italian wines, your shop, the Italian Wine Merchants. I remember when you first opened.
Probably the best, and I'm not just blowing smoke, probably the best Italian wine shop in the United States.
Well, I think only because, first and foremost, we do ship all over the United States, so our wines do make it to any state where it's legal for us to ship in. But then the second part is you have a fanatic like me that spends way too much time in Italy tasting way too much stuff, and you know, I like we said before, wine shops you don't do for you know, to become rich. You do because you love what you're doing, I guess, in a sense. And I do really enjoy what I'm doing, and I like sharing it with the world.
Well, and
the world likes you sharing it with them too.
Lucky you're
Thank
doing
you
it, Sergio. Thanks for writing the book, and thanks for coming on the show. And we'll see you in New York.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks so much, Sergio.
Sergio Esposito's wine memoir is A Passion on the Vine. You can find out more about it at restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 1155. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Tell you, Mark, talking with Sergio brought back a lot of great memories.
Some of
been to Italy in a couple of years.
Some of my fondest memories, and Sergio laments a little bit the long days of work, and it is work. There's no doubt about it, it's work. But it is the fondest memories I have of being in this business are traveling across the world, going to places, seeing people make wine in their homes across the world, how it's done, the philosophy behind it, the passion that goes into it.
But you brought up a very good point. There, when you go on a wine buying trip, we now try and plan it out very well. But in our sort of younger, more vulnerable years, you go to a lot of places, and if you visit, now think about this, if you're driving, mm-hmm. and it's all spitting during the day, if you visit, you know, six or seven wineries in a day, he does 10, that's a lot.
That's a lot.
But 6 or 7 wineries.
10 is a lot.
But 6 or 7 wineries in a day, and if we're out looking for new wines, there are two reasons we go. One is to cement relationships and taste new vintages with established producers.
And also to get a better understanding, to get some perspective of where the wine's coming from.
But with our friend Ovid, who was importing wines, mm-hmm. we were importing wines with him for a while, we were going looking for new producers. And you know what? You go to 7 wineries and 5 of them are lousy. And
right.
you drove a long way to taste some
and
lousy wines.
And 6 of them's mediocre, but there's that
day,
one magic in the bottle.
And every third day you find something. You mm-hmm. say, great, I'll have 200 cases of that.
Right.
Brought back in.
I remember that trip. It was the Rochemoine Sauvenair.
At the top of the mountain, off of the Loire River.
Spectacular, right next to Nicolas Joly.
Hadn't been in the
States
before.
Spectacular Sauvignon.
But we'd spent days, you know, mm-hmm.
searching and searching. We each went on separate trips to do the same thing.
But I will say that the one thing that is really nice is you do have an entree to meet people as not a tourist, and nobody parties like wine people. it is all work all day long. The tasting wine is work all day long. It's spitting, it's tasting notes, and you get a headache, but that's until like 5, 6, 7 o'clock, and then you have dinner.
And then you have, and you know, go to somebody's winery and have dinner in their wine cellar with the whole family around.
Well,
there's nothing like it. It's one of the greatest experiences of my life.
Or even just out at a restaurant with, you know, your American colleagues or your German colleagues who are there doing the same thing. Wine people are fun people. We're fun people. Hang out with us. I hope you've enjoyed the hour with the restaurant guys. I know we certainly have. I'm Francis Schock.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the restaurant guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 12 noon.